Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to Scaffold, a podcast featuring interviews with architects, artists, and designers. I'm your host, Matthew Blunderfield. In this episode, I speak with Stephen Bates, who together with Jonathan Surgeson founded Surgeson Bates Architects in 1996. The practice is known for its keen awareness of history, often looking back centuries in search of rich and complex buildings from which to learn. Although their projects are by no means imitations of the past, they do have a sense of solidness to them at odds with the ephemeral nature of contemporary digital culture. In place of a futuristic speculation often associated with well-known architects, though, they seem instead to look to the present, finding pleasure in the vagaries of everyday life. I met with Stephen in November at Surgeson Bates' London office in Clerkenwell, where we talked about, among other things, the influence that writing has had on the formation of the practice, Bates' reflections on teaching architecture in the UK, North America, and Europe, and the office's aversion to the open plans and blurred boundaries of modern architecture, embracing instead a sense of ambiguity and complexity in their work. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. I do, yeah. I mean, there's themes and questions I've kind of picked out. And I guess what I'm interested in starting with is the formation of the practice, especially around the years 94, 95, I think, when you were meeting with other architects, including, who is it, Tony Fretton, Adam Caruso, and then artists as well, Mark Pimlet.
Brad Lacour.
Yes, Brad Lacour, theorist.
Who's a Canadian also.
Really? And then theorists like Irénée Scalbert, and then, of course, Jonathan Surgeson and Jonathan Wolfe. You met for a year and a half.
That's right.
On a weekly basis and shared papers.
Yeah, it was Sunday morning for really up to a year and a half. And it was, in the end, a kind of group of friends who didn't have much work, most of us at the beginning of practice or weren't even yet starting our practice. Who realized that coming together and talking to each other helped. And I think because most of us had an interest in teaching, there was innately an instinct for trying to develop an intellectual position to practice. You know, it wasn't just about getting a job and paying the bills, but it was seeking meaning in work. And looking back, of course, it was an incredible privilege, and certainly Jonathan Surgeson and I both felt that it was formative for us as architects and for our practice.
So who instigated these meetings?
I don't really remember. I mean, the venue was Jonathan's flat in Marchmont Street in Bloomsbury, and it might have been something like Tony and Jonathan chatting over dinner or something one night. I really don't recall, but because it was Jonathan's place, I'm pretty sure that he was part of proposing it. But what was surprising was how consistent it turned out to be, you know, that people kept coming back, you know, because it was not intended to be like, now for the next year and a half we're going to meet, but it was, oh, what are you doing on Sunday? Why don't you come and have a cup of coffee and we're going to have a chat, you know. And I think with the kind of rigour of many of the characters, say like Mark Pimlott and Tony, it was immediately a critical event and an inquiring one. And quite quickly, the idea of writing came into play. So that early on, it was decided that we would come to the meeting with paper, with texts that we could read out and get a critical reaction to it. So it ended up being, for some people, and for certainly for Jonathan and I, a really great early discipline of trying to put some thoughts down on paper. And I remember we had mentioned images, and Peter, St. John and Adam were very keen on trying to work out what that was. And we were charged, you know, with, right, go and come back, you know, in next week and tell us about images. Mm. And it sort of started a little bit like that. But bit by bit, one's own instinct for inquiry developed, and Jonathan and I both wrote a separate text, which was really about the city, architecture in the city. Mine was entitled Way to Work, mm-hmm. which was, you know, in a way, it was the beginning of an exploration of the enjoyment of ambiguity, you could say, in words. So even the title, A Way to Work, was double meaning, because it was actually describing the two options of a way to the tube station that I had from my home to go to work. Mm-hmm. But of course, it was underlying that was an idea about context and mediation and emotion and atmosphere that was really beginning to inform a way of making work, mm-hmm. and how you make work.
You've referred to this essay in other conversations as kind of being seminal to your practice in some ways. And it's really interesting for me to have read it as well and kind of approaching it as an experimental piece of writing to a certain degree.
Yeah.
So this essay is collected in the first papers.
Yes.
Publication mm-hmm. that was published in 2001.
Right.
And this seemed to be a kind of the fruition of the early papers meetings you were having with these other architects.
Exactly, because there was an intention. The group did have a name eventually called Paper. It was going to be Papers on Architecture. Mm-hmm. Jane Shipchase, a graphic designer, developed a wonderful, beautiful identity for this. And the intention was to put all these papers together and make a book. Not everybody in the end wrote anything. That didn't really happen. There was no money. And in fact, we made an exhibition at the Architecture Foundation instead as a group, which was in those days in the basement of the Economist building. So mm-hmm. it was a really good venue. Because we didn't publish, but because that experience demonstrated to Jonathan and I that writing was a wonderful challenge, but a clearly an interesting and important part of both practice and teaching, we continued to write. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we made an exhibition of our work in the North London University, London Met, we decided to make a catalogue for that exhibition that was actually papers. And I mean, I look back at it and it was slightly, you know, confused, you could say, because it was a collection of writings, but it was also trying to show a bit of our work as well. Mm-hmm. Unlike papers 2 and 3 that were purer, more clear set of texts.
Yeah.
So papers 1 was something slightly different, but it was bringing together texts which were, most of them, published somewhere else, but we brought them together.
So I want to go back to that first exhibition held at the basement of the Economist building, which to me seems like there's a kind of mythologizing going on, which I'm really excited about and drawn to, and the way that we kind of make our own histories and establish our own narratives of practice. And so the Smithsons have had a major influence on Surgisson Bates. And, you know, the subject of New Brutalism is something that you've returned to again and again, most recently in a lecture in Porto, is that right?
Yes.
And
so very, very well informed.
But there's a kind of deep fascination with the movement that early on, as a budding architect, you and your partner Jonathan Surgisson were trying to align yourselves with.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I guess that paper's publication is a kind of test or a throat clearing or a initial posturing of, like, how do we fit in this lineage?
Exactly right, because we realized that we were part of a continuity. You know, we were looking backwards to understand what architecture could be for us. The Smithsons offered exciting things. They offered architecture which we didn't understand, and in many cases we thought was quite ugly. They offered poetic writing and a kind of magnification of everyday, the everyday experience, as well as a sensitivity to the past, historic past. And it was so exciting and new. Nothing like this had happened to us in education. Particularly the way they wrote about architecture, which has been maybe the one biggest influence in the end. It was less about New Brutalism, because in a way that is another fiction, you know, what that movement was in itself. We were drawn more to, you know, the Smithsons themselves. I'm speaking for myself there. But I mean, in parallel to that, certainly Team 10, the kind of movement that involves wonderful architects, Kodurk, Aldo van Eyck, really all who were challenged. What was interesting for us is the way that Team 10 challenged the a kind of inflexible modernist set of principles. They were trying to find a humanism within the modern movement that we instinctively connected with. So there was that broad story of Team 10, but it was a kind of, the Smithsons were more of a mentor-like influence, you know. We liked the idea that you could build really carefully, you could teach and you could write, you could say something about the culture of architecture in your practice. That was what we wanted to be, architects like that. Of course they were potentially quite difficult characters, and there was a whole load of other stuff going on which was more difficult for us to identify with, but what they were trying to do, we thought that's where we want to be. They helped position us. And in some ways some of their architecture started to do the same thing once we got used to it and got to know it a bit more. The Sugden House was in a way a reasonably quick and easy reference for us because of its dealing with a prototype, you know, the kind of traditional prototype. And Economist Building grew on us gradually as we started to become more and more fascinated with construction and a kind of condensing of elements. So the work came later, but the ideas and the mentality was the big influence.
It seems like it's a kind of attitude that the Smithsons proffered, which you and Jonathan were really drawn to.
Yeah.
And also this persona of the architect academic, or not even academic, but architect thinker.
I'd like to think of architect thinker because in this country, you know, academic is used in certainly in architecture, is negative.
Pejorative, yeah.
Yes, it's sort of, oh, you're a bit intellectual, aren't you? You know? And it's always troubled us because that seems ridiculous that you're not allowed to think, you know, make work. Uh-huh. And mainland Europe has a different attitude to architects who think or teach, which is, to be a good architect, you should be a good teacher, you know. Whereas in this country, you don't see that. Yeah. The famous architects are usually not teachers. You know, have never taught or did ages ago while they were never intending to be a teacher for their career.
Maybe this is a tangent we should quickly go off on then, because the practice is now split between London and Zurich.
Yeah.
Jonathan Surgeson runs the practice in Zurich. And I mean, has in the past lamented the state of architectural teaching in the UK. And I don't know what other drivers there were behind the division of the practice or the forking of the practice. But it does, and I've heard this from other architects as well, seem like it's not ideal, really, the state of architectural culture in the UK right now, and that it really is a pleasure and indulgence to be able to build in continental Europe the way it isn't in the UK.
I mean, first of all, I'd like to just, in a way, be more precise and correct about the two offices. It isn't, I wouldn't use the word split. I think that the practice has evolved over more than 20 years. Like any relationship, that the relationship between myself and Jonathan Surgeson, and then slightly more recently with Mark Tuff, our third partner, is one of a kind of evolving, wonderful, complex thing. And it would, just like the Smithsons, you could see, you know, that relationship evolves and changes and transforms. Circumstances also come into play. What I would say is what's going on is a kind of broadening of the practice. And the setting up of the Zurich office that was really instigated by Jonathan, I think widened our potential and allowed us to work in parallel, together and in parallel. Just in the way that, for example, we used to teach together and now we teach separately. I mean, in the end, if you look at how I teach and how Jonathan teaches, there are so many overlaps that are instinctive, that we're completely, together. But I think this latest situation has given us also a kind of wider platform in which to work. And I would say a wider platform for the members of the office to work as well. That was a point of detail. Mm-hmm. But what you were asking about about the condition of work. I mean, in London, first of all, the Zurich office really concentrates on working in Switzerland, and that's a very specific culture, a competition culture, and a way of doing things. And it takes years to learn how to do that and win projects, and that's beginning to happen in Zurich. In London, we work in 6 or 7 countries, Belgium, Spain, Germany. It's not just the UK. Mm. And so there are only 3 UK citizens in this office of 26 people, which says a lot. We have 9 languages in this office. And we like being in London because London is a fantastic place and this office is a fantastic office to be in. We like leaving London and coming back, and we know that both Jonathan and I really understand our Anglo-Saxon kind of character, particularly because we're working abroad a lot. You see yourself more clearly. Mm-hmm. But I think working in this country can be a pleasure, but it also can be difficult. I think if one's being very general, yes, it's true that the land values and the process-driven construction industry in which there are more managers than people who actually do anything, make anything, is a worrying situation, but it has an impact on how to build. But every country has its own problems, and many of them are overlapping, in fact. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I wonder that just because we know so much about this country, we know all the problems, and we're building in other countries and slightly more ignorant of those problems, but managing through almost naivety, building something, achieving something. Mm-hmm. But I would say that it's imperative to us to continue to build here. It's a shame that we don't teach here, but we both help out our colleagues who do teach in terms of critics and things. But we give so much to teaching that it doesn't make sense to do it for nothing. We have to also run a practice. And instinctively, we just find it unacceptable that teaching in this country is seen as a bit like a kind of favour and not a real professional responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is a big problem that someone has to... We stand up to and say that isn't acceptable. So we both teach in mainland Europe, in Mendrisio in Munich, and we have good structures there with assistance, a bit of money, and it allows us to make things and produce things and teach very seriously the way that we'd like to teach.
Mm-hmm. So you run a studio with Bruno Krücker.
That's right. TU München.
Right. And then what's interesting, just about something you said earlier, about the kind of cosmopolitan nature of the practice, which kind of extends into your teaching as well, because initially you and Jonathan taught at the AA, is that right?
Very early on. Jonathan first taught on his own, and then we taught together for the first years, and then we moved to Switzerland.
And you were visiting lecturers at ETH?
ETH, and then EPFL. Mm-hmm. We did also teaching in Harvard together.
That's right.
And in Oslo together. Mm. And at that point, we were then, the opportunity came for Jonathan to apply for the Mendrisio professorship, which he did and was awarded that position. And a year later, I was invited by Bruno to collaborate on a professorship, which was a really exciting and has turned out to be a really fulfilling relationship.
What's interesting about this itinerant pattern of teaching in different countries and different cultures is that you have a unique view into teaching or into cultures of teaching. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what your insights are about that, having taught in North America, the UK, and all these various other countries in continental Europe. What are the differences or similarities? What are the students like? What are the programs like? What is the ideal? I guess I have a clue.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in terms of the North American teaching situation, only through an intense semester at Harvard. At GSD, And the students were incredibly motivated, multicultural, but the environment was a very experimental one in such a way that Jonathan and I didn't feel particularly attracted to, that it was a theoretical experimentational architecture. And we were more interested in bringing a kind of sense of reality to play. You know, for example, we brought housing to the studio. That felt already like a bit like, that's a bit strange. And we proposed high-rise residential architecture because we felt that typology is a known one in that part of the world. And we were fascinated with how we could offer ideas of collectivity and in-between space that you see in abundance in the European city, and whether you could transfer some of that, in the end, quality of generosity into a high-rise building, into a North American situation where even the urban, the public realm is has a different status, you could say. So we were sort of provoking what we felt wasn't evident, wasn't there in the school. We worked with 1 to 10 models of interiors, which, you know, don't really happen, weren't happening at the time. It's very much kind of computer-based, very ethereal, and in full of amazing energy, but not much of it felt like you could build it.
Not a lot of realism.
Exactly.
I mean, this description is so familiar to me, having studied in North America. I went to school in Toronto.
Yeah.
And there, I mean, I feel like Harvard kind of sets the agenda, at least on the East Coast, and schools up and down, in terms of what's being taught. And also, there's a lot of migration from faculties as well. And so I'm familiar with this kind of ethereal quality of student work. And it's interesting because this is a point in my education where I was starting to discover European architecture as well.
Yeah.
And work by yourselves, as well as a slew of other practices, including Cruz Ascension. And for me, and I think a lot of my cohort, there is a kind of fascination with realness.
Yes.
And there is something kind of radical.
Yeah, maybe
all
it's
over
just a reaction.
About doing a real project all of a sudden.
Yes.
But my sense is it's still the case that architectural academia in North America is still very much speculative and very much rooted in a kind of fascination with complexity and information.
I think that's exactly what we experienced, because during our time we were invited to critics of other studios, which we accepted, you know, in a gentlemanly fashion. And I have to say it was quite disturbing, because it felt very difficult to be able to comment, because it was all about complex intellectual work. We weren't really sure on what basis you could critique this work, because what is it? Is it, it's just an intellectual position against another intellectual position. And whereas if you're showing how you make an adjustment to a place, you know, you have the place in which you can establish some readings towards. And I think the work one of the consistencies I would say in the teaching that we have in Europe, and the places that we've taught, either because we've been invited to bring teaching or we've been invited as a critic, and certainly our own positions personally, is that belief in the European city, you know, that there is potential in the 21st century with this idea of the collective, the idea of reform rather than whole-scale replacement, that you can build upon. You know, cities take hundreds of years and thousands of years to evolve, and this is just—it's just carrying on. You know, we're working with a level of sensitivity to change. You know, mediate means prepare for change. It's not only responding to what's there, but it's preparing for another phase. You know, and I think that's at the heart of what we do.
Thank you.
could talk a bit about the practice's relationship to technology.
Yeah.
Because I think this is kind of in tangent to this resistance that we're talking about towards complexity.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's a model making office.
Mm.
And I know that in the studios you teach, oftentimes you'll encourage students to start with the model.
Yes.
And then draw the plans.
Yeah.
And that it's a kind of visceral, yeah, explorative process.
Yeah.
And I guess tangent to that not resistance to technology, but skepticism of unnecessary technology is, I don't know how to put this, but a fascination with a certain type of character or way of being, which I think is embodied in this guy, Monsieur Hulot.
Monsieur Hulot.
I've seen him.
Yes.
I've seen him come up in a few of your
talks.
Yeah, And just, I didn't even know who this person was.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I know. I'm an architect, and I'm not a Tati enthusiast. I haven't really watched a lot of his films, but
there are two wonderful books about him, which I really recommend you read his life as a film director.
What are they called? Do you know? Okay, well, I'll put it in the show notes.
I'll tell you later.
But what, I mean, so for listeners who aren't familiar, Monsieur Hulot is a character in a lot of Jacques Tati films.
Yeah.
He's a kind of bumbling Luddite at odds with the world around him. And
at odds with the new world around
yes.
him.
Yes. And so, like, why your fascination with this character? What does he mean to you?
Well, he was a performance artist and a polemic. I think he had a strong agenda about the way the modern city and modern civilization was evolving at a time when it was changing so rapidly and fast. And he could see the wiping out of history and culture. I mean, you know, Versun architecture, et cetera, et cetera. And wanted to kind of raise that to people's awareness and to recognize what was still beautiful about the things that were seen to be old, out of fashion, whatever. So he placed himself against the kind of modern age, either through people or technology, and yes, sometimes was bumbling in any way consciously. What I feel he does for me is to raise awareness of community, raise awareness of things being made and improvising, the improvisation of things, of the city. I showed you, I mean, you maybe saw in my lecture in Lisbon, I have an animation of Mon Oncle, and he lives in this little old house. And it just the sequence of him arriving at the garden gate and eventually ending up at his room at the top of the house already is a sort of architectural pleasure, because the whole idea of promenade, of secret spaces in buildings, that buildings that don't explain themselves immediately in one moment, intrigue and mystery, mm-hmm, are all, for me, characteristics that are so valid in making the best of architecture, but are often nowadays seen as suspect or somehow, you know, not honest or something, whatever this terrible word honesty is. And so I show him and talk about him in that sort of provocation to remember that there are ways to make beautiful architecture. You know, I think of, for example, Elizabethan architecture. You know, over a period of 50 years, extraordinary things were made in this country, you know, before classicism really took hold and we were a provincial country that looked not very far out beyond our limits for influences, very particularly the Netherlands or the Low Countries in those days. But what you saw was a kind of pragmatism and improvisation. And that if you take, say, Hardwick Hall as an example, this is a building that is almost perfectly symmetrical in its facade, but the world inside is completely not representative of that. So the building, the face of the building says something about its context and about its owner, and about ideas of being modern, and in this case, enjoying geometry. But the interiors are another world, which is about ritual and hierarchy. And this mismatch has always fascinated me. And I enjoy the idea that you don't always see everything immediately, that you have to look again and again, or be invited that bit further and further in, and a world is uncovered, like the TARDIS, you know. I find that, in a way, that seems to be anti-modernist, you know, where transparency, borderless, threshold-freeness, a blurring of inside and outside are absolutely paramount. And I think all in their right place, those themes could be interesting, but to dismiss everything else for the sake of that seems, you know, ridiculous and simplistic.
There's a lot of, I mean, Hardware Call is a very personal precedent for you. It seems like it's come up repeatedly in different, in different forms of conversation or writing. And I guess instead of talking about that precedent specifically, what I'm interested in is this kind of like honing of an agenda or of a, of an architectural identity. Because there have been three papers, publications now. And I think that precedent has come up in all three of them, alongside an apartment of a friend of yours in Oporto.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's deeply personal and often unfamiliar to the reader. But it's almost like you're creating a universe for yourself.
Yeah.
And you're kind of letting us in a little bit. What I've noticed, though, is that the early writing, that first papers book, it was very, like, kind of raw.
Yeah.
And like I said, kind of experimental or like weird. I guess as you're becoming accustomed to what it means to write as an architect. And then also it kind of exhibits itself as a strange artifact because there's like three jackets or four jackets on it, right?
Yes.
What time do we have? Okay, I'll wrap it up. And then we have papers two, which is kind of embodying its design and the kind of type of paper you're using. And then papers three is a kind of academic, almost like bound thesis in a way. I had a really hard time finding these, actually. A lot, most of them are out of print. And it's only in the Reba library where you can sit and read them. And I'm wondering, like, who actually is the writing for, in a way? And like, what would it mean to publish these texts on a website, for example, for free? Or who is the audience, actually? Because there's this culture of like, kind of rarefied, enigmatic texts and architecture that go for hundreds of pounds on Amazon now.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. When the original motivation was to, because we valued the texts and they were hard work and they meant a lot to us, we wanted to put them together in a way that we could control and in some ways archive them, because otherwise they were, you know, in magazines, one over here and a publication somewhere else. So it was a little bit like a kind of archiving thing. We like to make books, you know, that's another thing we like to do, to make some physical thing. So that was an attraction. And I mean, the website and the kind of universal access for papers one and two is still was a new idea that wasn't really on our wavelength. Of course, we're more aware of it now. And by the time Papers 3 came, we felt that it really was, in the end, not an academic book, but a book of writing, and that it shouldn't try and be anything other than that. And lessons we'd learnt in Papers 2, we just transferred to Papers 3, but this time made a nicer cover, because we found a bit more money. But the question of who they were written for. Because each individual paper was written for a particular purpose. So each of them have their own purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Either they were a positional text that was written in our free time, you know, or they were a paper that was written for a teaching situation or a conference situation that then was adapted slightly to become a standalone paper.
Mm-hmm.
So they had their own purposes at the time, but put together they become a kind of anthology of a way of thinking. And that's why you'll see often overlaps or the reference of the same thing. I mean, you know, how many references does one have? I mean, it is understandable that certain things keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, sometimes I'm trying to avoid talking about the same project again or consciously trying to avoid it. But I think the other one is the English Terraced House, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
In Papers 3, it sort of appears all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't worry about that. We just said, well, that paper was written by Jonathan about this. And then I wrote something about something else, and it happened to be that we were working on the same reference, and it was just, that's fine, you know. Mm. Putting them together was as much a personal indulgence than anything else. Not printing too many copies made it, for us, strangely, not too much of a commercial stance. Uh-huh. And yet, of course, conversely, it's turned into a hugely commercial one. I mean, that's the ironic thing, that we thought, oh, well, let's just publish a few, you know, no one will want to buy it, but we're sort of doing it for ourselves. Mm. And now it's, oh, can I have a copy of Papers 3? How do I get that? You know, Papers 1 is out of print. Everyone I meet who knows about Papers wishes they had a copy of Papers 1. And I think that it's funny. It wasn't an intention, you know. Do I enjoy that position? Probably, because it allows us to celebrate the idea and the difficulty of writing and the importance that writing can be on practice. Some architects could get so much from writing, and we do, and we continue to do. What I think is a shame is this problem that maybe we have in this particular culture, which is a distrust, you know, a distrust of thinking too hard. Yeah. And I suppose that maybe that's our act of resistance against that, which is to say, you know, here are some texts. They're not academic, because we're not academics. They don't have the discipline of an academic, intentionally. We respect and too highly real academics to think that we can do what they do. But they kind of try and work things out all the same. And they, in some cases, enjoy using words, because ultimately that is what I enjoy most.
Can I ask one more question?
One more question.
Speaking of words, I mean, there's this interest in etymology that you've brought up
yes,
before.
Yes.
And speaking of academics, there's this one figure, Gottfried Semper, who reoccurs again and again as well. And I guess as a way of concluding the conversation, I mean, what, for people listening who aren't familiar with Semper's theories, how would you, in a kind of nutshell, this is so painful, I'm sorry. How would you kind of explain Semper's influence on the practice, or the way that Surgisson Bates builds now?
I think I'm right in saying, and maybe I could say from a personal point of view, but that Semper's work became more evident to me, strangely, via Kohlhoff.
Yes, you mentioned that.
By reading an essay he wrote about cladding, and in which he refers heavily to Semper, and slightly in parallel to that, reading the writings of Adolf Loos, so very different characters, you know. And that led to a kind of investigation, because we were, at the time, consciously moving our work from an architecture of layering, like fine layers of using a rain screen, to an exploration of weight and depth and a sense of strong material presence in the work that we were making. And Semper just sort of naturally became a kind of focal point to get to grips with how to make walls. You know, Kohlhoff describes very clearly the problem that we, or the reality of the situation now, which is because of the thermal layers, that the opportunity to build in the old way is, of course, gone monolithically. But that his point was that it doesn't mean that you can't build with rich texture and reveal and with representational value. And his references to Semper started to trigger a great interest, because Semper was always interested in trying to understand the source of things. So his interest in etymology was then, in, you know, you could say, inherited by me personally, because I am fascinated with the origin of things. When I think about the social development of an interior of a home, you know, or the meaning of the word wall, you know, both of them, when you track back, you find all sorts of things. Textile with the wall, and you know, ideas of what comfort could possibly mean, you know, when it comes to understanding an interior atmosphere. So I'm grateful for Semper for that sort of nudge to look at the origin of things. But I'm also grateful for him to recognize, as he did at the late in the late 19th century, that architecture, art, and technology were still intertwined. That you could, composition was still okay. You know, you could compose. And I have to say, you know, we were, through education and through sort of modernist teaching, composition was somehow not on the agenda. It was just the result of a whole load of functions that you put very carefully together, gave you a composed facade. And we knew that wasn't true, but we didn't have the confidence. And we felt that, by the way, through education, young architects don't have the confidence to compose often because they aren't given that courage to realize that they're stacking something on top of each other, and they have to do that in an artful way as well as use technology. Semper, who didn't make particularly great buildings, wrote perfectly about how to, you know, what the attempt was. And I think that that is, it just, you know, finding him at the right time meant that it's impossible to extricate him from who we are as architects, and certainly I feel I am. And he's like one of those important focal points, like the Smithsons, like you know, Elizabethan architecture, like these little, as someone described to me yesterday, tent poles in the ground that you, in the end, you realise create a kind of structure in which you're formed. And I suppose we make them a little bit public through the writing, but in the end, everyone has to find their own tent poles, you know? Good luck to them.
Stephen, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, no problem.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Andrew Raworth of the band Stanley Park, with additional music this week by Matthew Halsall. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. Thank you to Stephen Bates, and thanks to you for listening. This is the last episode of Scaffold for 2018. I'll be back again with more interviews in the new year.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.